Hello and welcome to the Local Economic Development Podcast.
Hosted by Sean Cunningham
and Jörg Meyer-Stahmer.
For other programs in this series, please take a look at www.ledcast.net.
In this episode, I'm going to have a conversation with Grant McKenzie, who's got a slightly unusual background because, Grant, you moved from being an entrepreneur to being an economic development professional to being a change management professional in a large corporate organization. So, first of all, welcome to our podcast series.
Thank you.
And why don't you just briefly sum up what you have been doing over the past, 15 or so years?
I've had quite a varied career going through IT, first of all. IT takes you through a whole range of different business activities within organizations. That gave me a real curiosity for how organizations work. I've got tired of working in large corporates, so started my own businesses. After a while, after those grow, I look for new challenges, so I've moved in and out of major organizations as well. LED was a fascination for me because it gave me a chance to work with other organizations and other entrepreneurs, understand what drives them, what makes them tick, what works, what doesn't work, in different business models, different contexts, and ultimately into change management now, where it's about driving business performance, and whether that's within a single organization or a network of organizations, the interplay and dynamics of that are a big challenge. Mm. And that's just a big playing field for me.
Yeah. Okay. So you're working now with a large financial organization, which we may or may not name. Just it's really up to you. And you have been working with Scottish Enterprise for quite some time, and that's how we got to know each other. So maybe let's start this conversation about change and change management by briefly introducing that little formula that you introduced to me recently.
Sure, yeah. For change, I start off with a very, very simple equation. Mm-hmm. And there are three factors on one side. D plus V plus E greater than C. Mm-hmm. Very easy to remember. So on the C side, that's the cost of the change, the financial cost, the emotional cost, the upheaval. Mm. And on the more complex side, we have three simple factors. Dissatisfaction with mm-hmm. the current situation, that's the D in there. So what's our reason to move away from what we've got today?
Yeah.
We've got V, which is vision. Mm-hmm. So if we want to move away from here, where are we going to? Otherwise, people go in different directions and we get something like chaos. Mm. And finally, there's E, which is arguably the most important element, engagement. Mm-hmm. And this is understanding who we need to engage, how we need to engage them to make that change effective.
Yeah. Yeah.
Out of each of those, there are a range of tools and techniques that fan out from each of those elements, depending on the type of change, the context, the circumstances, and what you want to achieve.
Right, okay. Maybe let's start with the D, dissatisfaction. So is that something that is a given in a typical change situation, or is it something that where you try to apply a bit of a helping hand to generate that?
It's rarely a given. In some cases, issues, systemic weaknesses, big challenges are quite obvious to many of the people involved. Mm. But actually getting people motivated to do something about it and move away from the current situation can be very tough, and it usually is quite tough. Mm. Human nature, people like to find the easiest way, and sometimes just accepting how things are is the easiest way.
Yeah.
So most times you have to give that a helping hand.
And then the second part was vision. What is that about?
In terms of making the change effective, and particularly when you apply it to LED and looking at territorial upgrading, there are so many actors, stakeholders, organizations involved. Mm. Unless you have a single vision that gives some sort of alignment mm-hmm. across all of those, it's very hard to get concerted effort.
So one of the related terms would be alignment among stakeholders, without which you're not going to get much traction.
Yeah.
And then the third one, just remind us again, was?
Third one was engagement.
Okay.
And one of the big paradoxes around this, a lot of people put effort into making the vision perfect. Mm-hmm. It's so good that everybody wants to follow it.
Yeah.
And the paradox is that the more you do that in isolation and the more you perfect it, the more it can alienate people because it's not their vision. Mm. So the way that you engage people in sharing that vision and in taking the steps to realise it is what will make the change effective. Okay. You have to get a critical mass of people willing to do that, a critical mass of followers, effectively, or the change will not happen.
Yeah. Now, this whole discipline of change management is something that has evolved kind of in the past 20 years, and it has, I think, mostly evolved within organizations, inside organizations, where sometimes organizations need to change because of external pressure or necessities or new environmental regulations or new financial or tax regulations or whatever. And sometimes they have to change because the performance isn't good enough, because they can't compete as effectively as they used to. So that is a context of change and change management where it would appear to the outsider that the system is pretty straightforward. So it's within an organization. It's within a hierarchy, a hierarchical organization, so basically somebody can order everybody to change. You have then a relatively clear starting point, a relatively clear motivation why you need change, and sometimes you also have a really relatively clear objective where you want to go with your change. And in the conversations that we've had in the past, you've often pointed out that it's not so much different in other settings, like in the typical LED settings that we are facing. Maybe let's try to work out why that is the case and why a loose group of stakeholders, diverse stakeholders in a locality or in a cluster isn't all that different from what it would appear like a very coherent group of people inside a large organization.
It's a good point. And one of the things I would have to disagree with you on is that it's not that simple within one organization. Mm-hmm. So although theoretically the chief executive officer can tell everyone to do something, it rarely happens that way, and it's really effective if they do. The principles that I've outlined are exactly the same within a single organization as within a network of organizations in, say, an industry cluster or some sort of territory. What is more complex is the whole stakeholder map. Mm-hmm. For the latter. Mm-hmm. Within a single organization, if someone is faced with change, they want to hear about the change from broadly one of two people, their line manager or the CEO. Mm. They look to those people for direction. Yeah. Within, say, a cluster, you don't have a single appointed leader like that. Mm. You don't have a hierarchy in place. Yeah. So you have to get much more imaginative about where people take their references from. Yeah. So this may be political leaders. More than likely, it will be role models, mm-hmm. either within business or other industry, or in some cases with celebrities or well-known people, that if they take a steer from there, they feel that it's a legitimate thing to do, it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Also from their peer networks. So that gives a slightly different approach in terms of how people are influenced in their decision-making. It's more complex within a cluster as opposed to an organization, but you would follow exactly the same rules, techniques, and principles.
So what do you say? It's not fundamentally different. It's to certain degrees slightly different, but it's not a fundamentally different situation. So what then happens when somebody tries to come up with change? I mean, it's one of the situations that, for instance, people in development agencies or professionals in donor organizations are facing all the time. They're often sent out to do change, to change the way certain organizations or certain localities are working. So where do you start? Especially, what do you do when you get the distinct feeling that everybody is right at the middle of their comfort zone and dissatisfaction is actually not all that high?
You need a combination of all three factors at play at all times. And depending on the context for the change, you may have to focus on one more than the others.
Yeah.
It's very hard to be specific without an example here.
Maybe let's start by taking an example from your experience inside organizations. So you have certain situations where legal changes force you to change the way your organization is running. But then there's also situations where it's more fuzzy issues in the framework conditions, where then some people inside your organization say, okay, we ought to do this differently. And they typically wouldn't meet with large applause when they come up with that message. So maybe we could take one of those cases and explore that a little bit.
I'll pick up on a recent change program that I've just been involved in, and this had a very high capital value attached to it. It's within the financial services industry in the UK, and the organization that I work for right now was investing around £100 million sterling mm-hmm. in bringing this change to bear.
Yeah.
It was driven by regulation, by the Office of Fair Trading in the UK. And you would think that's quite simple. We've been told what to do. We need to get on and do it.
Yeah.
As with any change, there's a natural human reaction to it, where people go through denial, they go through anger, mm-hmm. A sense of frustration, because this, on the face of it, is a massive distraction from us doing our core business.
Yeah.
It's a big capital investment. It earns us the right to stay in a particular market. It doesn't grow our market, it doesn't grow our profits.
Yeah.
So initial reactions when it was first discussed were, well, can't we just refuse to do it?
Mm.
Can't we ignore it? We can let the other financial institutions do this.
Yeah.
It doesn't apply to us. And that's fairly typical. I mean, I've worked with around 200 organizations during my career, and you see the same reactions again and again. So even something that should be absolutely black and white, which is it's driven by regulation, faces exactly the same types of challenges and reactions within the organization. So although the mandate to do it is very clear-cut, what that results in within this particular example is that by the time we overcome that inertia, that resistance, that level of denial, we're very late to mobilize. And that really begins to restrict what can be achieved in the time frame and presents big challenges.
Okay. So what do you do in a situation like that where you are facing anger and denial and dissatisfaction is not really in place? Do you create dissatisfaction then artificially, or what do you do?
Yes, in this particular case, what we had to do was articulate what life would be like if we did not follow down the route of that change.
Okay.
Understand what it would be like to be left out in the cold in a particular market, the competitive disadvantage we would find ourselves at, say, in 5 years' time, what that would mean in very real terms regarding profit, individual bonuses, and try to tie it back to some of the key decision makers as to what does it mean for them? Does this mean our organization's in a weaker position? Does this mean their position is weakened?
Yeah, yeah.
Does this affect them financially as well as the wider bank?
Yeah,
and begin to create some sort of platform that says we need to do something about it. And really that's the start of the change. We know we need to do something. And it takes us on to the next part, which is, well, what is that something? Mm.
So which then takes you into kind of an open-ended process where the rough direction is clear, but it's not at all clear where exactly you're going to end up.
Yes, that's right. And that's where vision comes into play, which, again, in this particular example, the directive set out by the OFT was not that prescriptive.
Mm.
There were three things that they wanted to see achieved by the industry. So first of all, we had to find out what the rest of the industry thought.
Yeah.
Were we all striving for the same things?
Yeah.
And did we all mean the same things when we used that terminology? And what we found is that we all had a very different picture in mind.
Right.
So step number one was to try to work out what this meant for the industry and get everyone to ascribe to that.
Maybe let's move the perspective then a little bit into this kind of situation that we've often seen within the scope of development initiatives, where you try to interact with a group of industry, with a group of companies in an industry or a group of companies in a given cluster. And as you talk to those guys, you get the distinct feeling that they are reasonably comfortable. It's not like, I mean, every business is complaining most of the time about something, but you often get this feeling that they are not really that uncomfortable and they are not really that keen to try fundamentally different things. And still you look at them and you know, if they don't change quite profoundly, they're going to be wiped out during the next 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 years. So in a situation like that, where do you start when you don't have dissatisfaction really? Where do you start with a change effort?
The good thing with most entrepreneurs and most business people is that they understand the importance of progress and the importance of developing their products, their services, and reinventing what they do. Most people understand that standing still in real terms is beginning to go backwards relative to their competition. Perhaps the biggest challenge that I faced in working with cluster initiatives with Scottish Enterprise is that many of these industries can be quite inward looking, and they look at their relative market share, their local market share, and their local competitors. And if they have a comfortable share within their own local territory, they tend to feel quite comfortable with that. History is a great lesson here in terms of other industries, other regions, other countries that had a real profile for doing something that have lost it over the years because they did not pay attention to international competition or competition from other regions, and in some cases competition from other technologies outside their own industry. And being able to show external threats and begin to shift perspectives, get them looking externally rather than internally, can create some of that dissatisfaction to accelerate the efforts.
So when you then start a process like that, what do you do? Do you get everybody around the table, or how would you start?
There's a variety of different ways, and I guess it depends on your relationship with actors in the industry. One of the key ways to do it is by conducting research, looking at the long-term prospects for a particular industry within a certain region, where the main competitors lie outside, how easily or otherwise they could access the local markets that our industry enjoys today.
Yeah. I mean, in industries that we often see in developing countries, which sometimes haven't been exposed to any foreign competition so far, that is a very abstract threat, and people wouldn't find that credible. So that might work, but it also might not work. So then what else could you try?
Another route would be to look at the individual ambitions of some of the business leaders. Are they happy just to reach a certain size within a local market and plateau at that point? Or do they want to go on to achieve bigger and greater things? And link it through to much more of the vision side, as in the dissatisfaction then comes from not achieving everything they could do rather than losing what they already have. And you could also approach it along that axis.
What are the kind of people you would start with? Would you engage with everybody, or would you engage very selectively?
Very selectively. If I can pick another example from work that we did with the textiles cluster over in Thailand. Thai entrepreneurs are renowned as being fiercely competitive. And the big joke is that they don't even play team games very well because they are quite individualistic. And there was a lot of doubt whether we could get enough people working collaboratively to form a cluster around textiles. We looked at some of the common problems that they faced. There were three or four that kept coming up again and again throughout all subsectors around this. And what we did was to look for four, five, six senior business people that had the respect of others within their industry. Perhaps they were involved in chambers of commerce or trade associations, local politics, but they also ran a business, so they had some profile there. And we got them to work collaboratively with others in their sector where they did not share exactly the same customer base. So they had enough in common to make it worthwhile addressing the problems, but there was no immediate competition. Once we'd got some momentum around that and addressing the problems, we used local media and local networks to tell direct competitors of these senior business leaders that they were getting ahead by working with other companies. And all of a sudden, we got the competitive energies that previously stopped any collaboration were working for us. Because one of their nightmare scenarios would be their local competitor getting an immediate advantage by taking part in this cluster initiative. So suddenly we had 10, 20, 50, ultimately more than 100 companies all clamoring to become part of a cluster initiative. And it was just by making sure that we channeled that competitive energy in a different direction.
There's, coming back to the issue of change management as a discipline, there's all these manuals that you find around with all sorts of tools that you can apply if you need to facilitate a change process within an organization typically. To what extent have you found it useful to draw on such manuals, on those tools that are available, and apply it in the context of, say, a cluster initiative?
Very selectively. I mean, there are some tremendous change tools and business improvement tools, and primarily they are designed to work within one organization. So a lot of the lean manufacturing techniques, continuous improvement, Six Sigma, Kaizen, are great at making a business perform better. Yeah. There are other transformational change tools around project management and so forth that work well within organizations, and it's those ones that tend to work quite well outside organizations as well, as part of a wider industry initiative, for example. Some of the ones that really serve best are around stakeholder management, others around communications, visioning, leadership. And these are all soft skills. These aren't hard mechanical, you know, skills such as project management, which is about milestones and measuring outputs and so forth. These are very much about human interaction, how we influence. And the key difference going from within an organization to outside is to do with span of control. Because within an organization, ultimately, you do one person somewhere will have control over what happens in there, even if that's quite tough in the process. Within an industry, that doesn't exist, and that's where delivering change through influence rather than change through control really comes into play.
Now, one of the reasons why I've personally become interested in this whole issue of change management is that my hypothesis would be that it gives you a couple of tools that you can use even if you are not intuitively good at this, even if you are not bringing kind of a natural talent to do something like this, right? I mean, some people are change facilitators by nature. They were born to be that, or it's in their genes, or it's in their early socialization. They are just the kind of born change agent. But there's many other people around who've learned this over time, and who can rely on certain tools to do this very, very effectively, even if it's not in their genes or their early socialization. First of all, would you share that view, or is it mildly naive?
I think it's change management as a core competency is something that pervades so many other areas, and it's certainly something that served me well working in LED. And some of the techniques there, I mean, MesoPartner use those as well in terms of what they're doing. There are some very simple and very powerful techniques that can be used on a regional basis, across industry basis.
Just name a few.
Stakeholder mapping is an obvious one for me, and what I tend to use is just a very, very simple 2x2 matrix, which is a power interest grid. And understanding who is interested in what you're doing for either positive or negative reasons, and is it a high or low interest, and then the amount of power that they can bring to bear in all of that, is that high or low, and that just helps with the whole prioritization piece. The engagement part of the equation that I used at the start can be very, very time consuming, particularly where you need to engage with someone face to face on a one-to-one basis, and you have to be very selective about who you do that with, because you can't get around everybody. It's just physically not possible. And that, for me, is one of the best ways to understand who is worth investing that amount of time and that amount of effort in influencing and engaging and trying to get support from. People who have a strong interest but low power, for example, tend to be very well disposed to what you're doing and a fantastic source of information for your project, your program, whatever the change is that you're trying to affect. People with high power but low interest, as much as anything else, you just want to keep them satisfied. They don't want to be disadvantaged or inconvenienced by it. So you would deal with them in a quite separate way. The style of communication with them and everything else would be quite different.
That's one example of a tool that we would use in within change management. Is there something else that we could maybe also mention that is kind of more change-ish? That is something that kind of, well, as a tool, impersonates this whole metaphor of change.
One of the other techniques that I've seen work very well, either to create a sense of dissatisfaction or to try and convey some sort of vision, is to try to make the change real for people so they can experience it rather than just hear about it.
Yeah.
And there are some very simple examples that we've seen in the UK recently. There's a celebrity chef, a guy called Jamie Oliver, who some people may or may not know. And he went on a campaign to try and improve the quality of food in schools, being fed to school children. And he faced enormous resistance from schools, from parents, from the kids themselves, who liked eating poor food, high in fat, low in nutrition. And one of the things that he did to really bring it home to the kids is he did a demonstration where he showed them exactly what went into their food, where he took the remnants of mechanically reclaimed meat and cooked them in front of them. And it disgusted the kids to the point where they didn't want to eat it anymore. And it's trying to make that change real for people so that it's not just a theory. It's not just someone who's talking. They can see it, touch it, feel it, smell it, taste it. And that's one of the most powerful ways of doing it. Another good example was, it's quite a well-known story for a glove manufacturer, where they left hundreds of pairs of gloves on the boardroom table without telling any of the board what they were doing. And these guys came in for the board meeting and they were picking up pairs of gloves that all looked pretty much the same, but they all had vastly different prices on them, different styles, colours and so forth. And they were really confused. And then one of the product guys came in and said, "We make every single one of these." And if you're confused, think how your customers feel. And it's that, experiential learning that really brings it home, which is, okay, we've got to do something about this now.
Yeah, okay. One of the other things that we've been talking about is that a change process is never really a linear process. Maybe let's try to explain that feature.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Many people, when they're planning an initiative or a project, they tend to do it in a very linear way that across the next 24 months they will achieve a sort of an incremental improvement. And if you map it out, it's pretty much a straight line. That's not how things work. What we've found across many, many programs is that initially you always get a few people who are interested in anything that's new.
Yeah.
Whether it's because they're bored, because they're innovative, or they're entrepreneurs, or they're just drawn to something that's different in some way. Following on from there, you likely get some early adopters who can see something in it, perhaps not sure exactly how it's going to play out, but they think there's merit in it and they support it. The next stage on from there, you tend to get an early majority who begin to think, yes, there's some real potential in this, followed by a late majority, and then some people that will never ever change, either because they want to be different from the crowd or because it's not something that suits their lifestyle. And if you plot out over time how people become involved in change initiatives, it forms a bell curve, a fairly standard bell curve of distribution across the different categories I've just outlined. Now, if you actually stack those up one on top of the other, it forms a fairly traditional S-curve that economists will be familiar with. And if you overlay the straight line that people plan for across the S-curve, over the early stages of any initiative, you get this area which we call mind the gap. Because people expect things to mobilize far faster than they do. And if you are a senior business leader investing in a change, if you're a venture capitalist who's investing in a new technology, and you don't see this performing in the short term how you think it's, how you expect it to perform along that linear route, very often people lose confidence and withdraw their support. And one of the key things for anyone that's trying to lead a change through all of this is to manage expectations around that. To say, no, actually, all the evidence shows that it lags way behind the linear path until really that early majority begin to adopt the change. And then you see it leap past that straight line linear path when you really gain momentum. But it's very easy to lose faith and lose belief in the change that you're trying to bring in during that early phase.
Maybe let's wind up this conversation with maybe something like one golden rule or something that everybody who's involved in change, facilitating change, should keep in mind all the time.
Really, there are two things that you need to do if you're going to be involved in leading any sort of change. Mm. Two things that you must preserve at all costs. The first one is credibility. So if you're trying to lead any sort of change, who are you to tell anyone that you're going to somewhere better? What is your track record, either in that industry, with that technology, with that region, or as a business practitioner that gives you that credibility? Why should people follow you? The second one is trust. And it's absolutely pointless to create scare stories for dissatisfaction, because that eats at credibility. Equally, if the vision is oversold and you destroy trust, nobody's going to follow you there. So those are absolutely fundamental. And from there, it's understanding the interplay, the dynamics around the engagement that will make the change effective.
Thanks a lot for your time, Grant.
Okay, thank you.